You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, cloudy Davis day. Hey, Don, how much rain did we get in this storm?
It rained. First of all, it is not a bright, beautiful day here in Northern California. It's an overcast day. And the last 2 days have felt very much like winter to a bunch of Northern Californians because we went from summer to winter really quickly here. Right now, it is, October 15th, 2025. We're recording the show for broadcast on October 16th, 2025. The temperature is 54 degrees. Our high today is going to be 62.
62. That was the low a couple weeks ago.
Indeed. Our low tonight will be 48 degrees. To answer your question of how much rain we got, it was 1 to 2 inches around the area over this last storm, over the last couple of days, more than we expected, actually, in this area. It's gotten to the point the National Weather Service Sacramento office is not giving as much detail as they used to. So I now follow meteorologists in various parts of the state. And the places where meteorologists were getting excited were Southern California, Northeastern California, and Northwestern California, where a fair bit of rain, snow, and rain was expected in that order of those regions. And they did get quite a bit of rain in some parts of the American Southwest. There's significant flooding, of course, in Arizona and other places. And they got a pretty good amount of rain over in Wine Country, 2 to 3 inches of rain in some of the weather stations there. Mostly in the Sacramento area, we hit 1 to 2 inches. And Davis officially, let's look here and see exactly what our weather was over our rainfall was over the last storm. And the water year precipitation total is 1.27 inches is what they're indicating for the University Airport. Most areas around Sacramento and Vacaville got more than that, closer to 2 inches. The meaning of that is we've now received soil saturation to about a foot depth. So that's really cool. You can get out and do some planting now. Don't be surprised if you go to dig a hole to plant a 15-gallon tree and it's still dry further down. So if you're going to plant bigger woody plants, you probably still need to soak that spot a couple days ahead of time. But we have gotten enough rain to make it a lot easier to plant 1 gallon things. If you've gone to nurseries or the arboretum sale or native plant sales, you got those 1 gallon perennials and shrubs and things like that. They should go in very readily now that we've had an inch plus of rain in the area. If you are doing a bigger plant, you'll probably want to excavate a somewhat deeper hole and do a little soaking beforehand. But it's good to get an inch or two of rain. The other thing that it's going to do is bring up a nice crop of weeds. That's already happening on my farm. From the little bit of rain we had a week prior, I have a nice green coating in the open areas of my farm. Easiest time to control a weed is in the seedling stage. You can do whatever you like to it in that stage. You can take a hoe. You can bury it with mulch. You can put a tarp over it for a week or two or even longer. You can use any of a number of weed killers. This is a great time to get out there and deal with those weeds as soon as they come up. The 2 to 4 leaf stage of every weed is the easiest stage to control. So keep that in mind. This is an inch of rain will bring up a nice crop of weeds, and it's a great time to get out and prevent a whole lot of work for yourself a few months down the road right now.
So, Don, when you're out there and you got that green fuzzy layer of little things sprouting,
yeah, cute.
How do you know if it's a weed or if it's a wildflower?
Well, that's your definition. So if you decide you want it, it's no longer a weed. I mean, when you take plant science class at UC Davis, one of the first things you learn from your plant science professor when you're learning about weeds is it's a matter of definition. The picture they showed that I thought was a classic was a field of beans that had some corn plants in it from the previous year's crop. And the professor said, the corn this year is a weed. Last year, it was a crop. So it's all a matter of definition. But if you are planting wildflower seeds, it's really important to learn what the seedlings look like so that you're not carefully hoeing out those California poppies that you scattered.
So since the little weed seedlings have come up, would it be appropriate to go out and I've got a little hula hoe. Can I just hoe off all that green stuff so that it's not there and then spread the seeds?
Yes, this would be great. Wait about a week because that's what it's going to take for a lot of these to germinate. And then a hula hoe, by the way, the other name for it is an action hoe. It's a unique tool that both cuts off weeds both on the push and the pull. And so it makes it easier for you. And it does require that the soil not be too muddy. So you might want to wait a couple to a few days after a rainstorm and you'll find it works really, really well. And yes, it just cuts right under those little seedlings and kills them instantly. And if you recognize your California poppy seeds and you've got some out there, go around them or, as Lois alludes, hoe off all those weeds. Now you have some nice broken up soil that's been gently cultivated. Throw some wildflower seeds there. The biggest issue with wildflower seeds, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more as we get to some of the questions, is the weeds that come up when you plant them. Let's get back to the weather real quickly here. We've got a few more days, well, no more days of rain. We're going to be 71 degrees on Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 49 degrees Thursday night. Friday will be 72 and sunny. Ooh, that'll be beautiful. Friday night, 52 degrees and clear. Saturday, 75 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, 53 degrees and clear. Sunday, 74 and sunny. Nursery professionals, you're going to be very busy this weekend. Sunday night will be 52. Monday will be 71. Monday night, 50. Tuesday, 71. A few nights below 50. Most of you that are going out to your vegetable garden are finding the tomatoes are perhaps spoiling as fast as they're ripening. So if you still have some out there with color on them, you might take a gamble and find out over the next few days whether the warmer, drier conditions allow them to ripen out there, or you could go ahead and bring them in and ripen them on the kitchen counter. The summer vegetable garden is winding down for most people, but we're still going out and finding a cucumber here and some ripe tomatoes there and some peppers ripening. And of course, we're very actively planting cool season vegetables. We've got our average rainfall for October has already happened. So that's a great start for the rainfall year. I just want to mention one of our listeners stopped by. He was in Davis for a meeting. Lucy came in and said hi, and I want to say hi to Corbin. Hey, Corbin. Lucy's mentioned that Corbin is the kid who likes to fall asleep listening to the Davis Garden Show. My favorite fan comments ever. So glad to have you listening, Corbin. Nice to see you, Lucy. Speaking of which, La Nina has developed in the Pacific Ocean. And this is from the Weather Channel, of all places. It will persist through winter. Here's what that means. That does have, you know, generally correlates with high rainfall in some areas, low rainfall in other areas, but weak La Ninas are less impactful, as they say, less predictable. The conditions are present favored to persist through about February of 2026, then a transition to neutral conditions and perhaps trending back towards El Nino at that point.
Define La Nina.
Cooler ocean temperatures, and it can affect weather patterns across the entire United States as well as globally. Usually means a warmer winter in the American South. Usually means a colder winter in the northern plains. It typically means a wetter than normal winter in the Pacific Northwest and the Ohio Valley because of the way the storms track, and a drier winter for the southeastern United States. And the least predictable, least affected part of the country is northern and central California. So we generally...
who cares?
I mean, it's often associated with drought. El Nino patterns are the ones that we see a strong correlation with rainfall in our area from the strong El Nino. The first research on the Southern Oscillation, which is the term for La Nina, El Nino, was done at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. That's where my parents both happened to work. So my mother, like many mothers of her generation, would clip newspaper articles and mail them to me about this ongoing research, bearing in mind, no email, no internet, none of that existed back then. Mom was the internet. So mom would put these articles in the paper and mail them to me. And there was a pretty clear and convincing evidence that a strong El Nino correlated with higher rainfall in our area, Northern California. So I started saving that those articles and that data, and I finally constructed a chart that 4 or 5 years ago that showed about 40 years of El Nino and rainfall in Davis. They tracked, I mean, it couldn't have been closer practically for how they tracked. Strong El Nino year, high rainfall year, those are our flood years. We're getting a weak La Nina, least likely to have any impact on Northern California. Maybe we'll have a normal rainfall year. Wouldn't that be amazing? 17 to 20 inches of rain, 1 to 2 inches at a time, evenly spaced about 7 to 10 days apart. This nursery professional and most farmers in the area would appreciate that if you could arrange that. The average temperature. The average temperature on a day is the average of the low and the high. So how quickly did we progress from summer to winter? Lois was complaining as we were getting ready for the show. It's winter. I said, no, it's fall.
No, it's winter.
It was a very dramatic change. The average air temperature 3 weeks ago was 74 degrees. The average air temperature yesterday was 54 degrees. So that's a pretty dramatic drop over a 3 week period. We're not accustomed to that here.
Yeah.
We're definitely feeling fall, and people are in the mood. We're getting the question, is it time to plant this? Or my favorite one, is it too late to plant this? And just broadly speaking, the temperatures and soil conditions right now are utterly perfect for almost everything. How's that?
Tomatoes? Can I plant tomatoes?
Except tropicals and subtropicals. So the question, obviously, tomatoes would be, you know, spring or early summer, but the question comes up about things like citrus. Well, I mean, citrus are subtropical plants. They'll go in well now. That's just one example.
Warm soil.
Just be prepared. The soil works well. The soil is still warm. Still got plenty, you know, the soil is in good condition. There's some moisture in there. But the young tree will be vulnerable to frost damage more so than it would be if it had had, say, a full summer of growth. So when I do plant citrus, I have three or four that I'll be putting in over the next few days. I generally put four small stakes around the tree. I just do that at the time of planting. I put the tree in, I adjust it, I stake it for support, and then I put four small stakes around it, 3 to 4 foot tall, just a little bit taller than the tree. That's just in case we get colder than average, and it's a more vulnerable type, or it's a younger, you know, just out of the greenhouse citrus tree. I want to be able to go out there and cover it with frost blanket if we get unusually cold. January 2025, so last winter, we got to 23 degrees for several hours in the third week of January on our farm, and it did significantly damage six of my young mandarins to the point that a couple of them I looked at and thought, you know, I might as well just replace these because they were so badly injured. I had not put the four stakes around them. I did not cover them with the frost blanket. I don't always follow my own best advice. So if you're planting citrus, particularly if you're planting lemons or limes, because they are more cold sensitive, I'll throw in citron, the Buddha's hand. There's probably a couple others I could think of, but those are on the warmer needing end of the spectrum. They're more frost tender, more cold tender. They should probably just have some stakes around them. Yes, frost blanket will be all it takes in most cases to get them through a couple cold nights or a cold episode as we do get here every couple of years. I've been tracking this for a long time. On my farm, we get to 23 degrees every 2 to 3 years, and that's cold enough to injure a young citrus. In town, you're unlikely to get that cold. The night we got to 23 in town, most people recorded 27, 28, 29 degrees. That would injure a young citrus, or could. So it wouldn't be a bad idea if you're planting subtropical plants at this time of year to go ahead and prepare for frost protection later. Other than that, go for it. Everything else goes in well now. Winter vegetables, cool season vegetables. Lots of flowers can go in right now. Just looking at my orders for this week, there's lettuce and kale and broccoli and broccolini and broccoli rabe and collards and kohlrabi is on there this week. Things like celery, all the kitchen herbs except for basil, which is tender. You know, all the other kitchen herbs go in fine right now. Flowers like snapdragons, calendulas, pansies, violas, stock, sweet alyssum can go in anytime. Dianthus can go in anytime. Sweet peas you can still plant. You can still plant peas for eating. Keep those separated in your yard because sweet peas are poisonous and regular peas, of course, are not. So bear that in mind. Don't put them all on the same fence. And so there's all kinds of things you can put in your vegetable garden right now. Or if you're not a vegetable garden person for cool season stuff, if you're just a summer vegetable person, great time to mulch, great time to plant cover crops, fava beans, clover, grasses, depending on what your particular goals are. So all of that can happen now, as can the planting of native plants, And many people are planting wildflower seeds now. So we'll get to that particular topic shortly. But it's a great time with the soil conditions right now, the temperatures we have, and the temperatures in the next 1 to 2 weeks especially, ideal for all those kinds of projects, and also for throwing seed out into your lawn and meadow areas.
So one of the folks who came in to Don's store and talked to him was interested in milkweed. Now, we have a script in front of us. Don, do you want to read your part, or should I do both parts?
Oh, the script. Okay, hold on here. Yes, let me pull that up. I should be more prepared for these things.
You know, before the show, I do tell them the order in which we're going to do
it. Yeah, stuff. Right. Open recent. There we
Not
go.
My fault.
I want to plant some milkweed. Here we go. All right, go ahead. I want to plant some milkweed. You can do that.
No. You're going to do your part. Yeah. I'll do the customer's part. Okay. I want to plant some milkweed.
We have some here. This is the type that's native.
Oh, does it grow here?
Thinking to myself, well, that's what native means. But yes, this is the native species in this area.
Ah, is this a good time to plant it?
Well, it's going to go dormant shortly, but it will transplant fine.
Dormant? What does dormant mean?
It is going to look as though it's dying right after you plant it. But the roots are alive, and they establish, and they resprout from the stem in the spring.
Oh, so it doesn't bloom through the winter?
No.
Well, then what do the monarch butterflies do?
They aren't supposed to be here then.
Oh. So this isn't a good time to plant them.
It's a good time to plant milkweed. It's a fine time to plant milkweed. You won't see any monarchs until next year, if then, and the plant that you put in will look as though it's dying because it's going dormant. But it is, in fact, a good time to plant plants, transplant milkweed.
Huh. Is it a good time to plant milkweed from seed? That'd be cheaper.
If you post that question on a California Native Plant Society Facebook page, as somebody did, you'll get quite a diversity of answers. I can tell you as a nursery person, I'm going off script here. As a nursery person, milkweed can be very challenging from seed. There are a lot of species out there. When I'm talking about milkweed and native species, I'm usually referring to Asclepias fascicularis, the narrow-leaf milkweed, or Asclepias speciosa, the showy milkweed. I'm not talking about the tropical one. I'm not talking about species that you might have in the southeastern United States or the mid-Atlantic states. There are dozens and dozens of species of Asclepias, and it's generally recommended that you find a species that's suited, that is actually native to your region. We have found that fall planting does not give good results. That's been our experience. Part of it is that Asclepias fascicularis does benefit from soil stratification, cold stratification. So you need to put the seed into a refrigerator for 30 days prior to planting. Our experience has been that if we do that, and then we plant the seed mid to late winter in our greenhouse, the seedlings come up basically the same time we're planting pepper plants. The seedlings come up, although slowly, and the germination percentage is pretty low, but we get better results doing that. Stratify it first, plant it in a greenhouse in mid to late winter for transplanting out into larger pots in our cases, or out into your garden if you're just a home gardener in the springtime. I have gotten much better results with that. There are people who very firmly and emphatically state on the California Native Plant Society Facebook page that it should be fall planted. Go for it. My guess is your percentage of germination will be very, very, very low. And those little seedlings will have to compete with all the other things that come up in the fall and the winter here, including grasses and mustards that get taller than the milkweed and will tend to shade out those seedlings. So if you plant them in open areas where you can mulch around the seedlings if you do see them in time, and keep the grasses and the mustards pulled, you might get, let's say, 3 to 5% germination from the seed that you scatter out there. I think your money and time would be better spent with a midwinter seeding into containers for transplanting out in the spring. That was a long answer to a short question.
Well, actually, I have more questions. Yeah. So this plant that I planted, the native ones, the two you said,
yep,
will they grow in the shade or do they need full sun?
They will bloom only in full sun, in my experience. Now, the fascicularis, the narrow leaf milkweed, well, it's not one of the most spectacular milkweeds. It's really easy to grow. It naturally occurs on my farm. You know, it's one of the native wildflowers that is here. The places where it grows on my farm are kind of instructive. On the edges of where the oats and the mustard dominate, it will grow. Where they dominate, it will not grow. They outcompete everything. Our non-native grasses like oats, in particular, and non-native plants like mustard, which gets tall and dense, will shade out just about anything. They'll shade out weeds, which is great. They'll also shade out California poppies and tidy tips and red maids and narrow leaf milkweed and all those other things. You just won't get them to establish if you have those taller winter weeds in those areas. So where the narrow leaf milkweed does well on my property is where it's just lightly shaded, too much for the oats, too much for the mustard to do well, and just right for this and some California fescue. And so I tend to have those plants dominating in areas that are on the edge of where these non-native grasses and mustards grow. If I didn't have the mustards and the grasses, and there is one place where I don't have those, where I've managed to mow and keep them out, the narrow leaf milkweed is doing great there in full blazing hot sun with zero irrigation. And it blooms in the middle of the summer and does what it's supposed to do. And then I watch as the big fluffy seed things form and blow off in other parts of the farm. And here and there they come up, but in very, very small numbers. So this is a delicate little plant in its appearance, and it's a little delicate as a seedling. It takes a little effort to get it past the first full growing season and to become an established plant on your property. Once you've done that, it'll tend to naturalize pretty well, unless you have a lot of competition from the winter weeds.
So from what you're saying, there's no evergreen milkweed, is there?
There is. It's the tropical.
Tropical milkweed
is not evergreen here. So this is an important point. Obviously, everybody is telling everybody not to plant tropical milkweed because of the possibility that it would cause monarchs to overwinter in a place where they shouldn't, and because of the buildup of a particular parasite that occurs on the tropical milkweed. First important note, that parasite also occurs on other forms of milkweed. So if they overwintered, it would be the same problem with them. Tropical milkweed in USDA Zone 10, coastal California, parts of Southern California, does not die back in the wintertime. It was for a long time very popular in nurseries. Why? Because it will bloom the first year from seed. So you can grow it and flowers and you can sell it. It's a very attractive plant. In those zones, there's concern about the impact on the monarchs. And so, in fact, the ag commissioners in some of the coastal counties have banned the sale of tropical milkweed. But there is a simple solution, whether you're in one of those counties or not. Cut it back at least once a year. Going into the winter would be a good time to do that. That way you don't encourage the carryover of the disease and you don't encourage the overwintering of the monarch. Anywhere outside of that, and I've grown tropical milkweed here on my property, it freezes, it dies in the winter. So the issues that you'll read about for tropical milkweed elsewhere are not relevant here. To directly answer your question, in our zone, USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zone 14, there are no evergreen milkweeds.
What does it take to get the caterpillars here?
It takes a monarch butterfly, yes. And this is, I'd get this question every summer. I've been planting milkweed and I've never seen monarchs, et cetera. They're hit or miss here. You can't guarantee they're going to come in and find your place. Think about the distribution of milkweed plants. I mean, they're not, every house doesn't have them. You don't have whole zones where there's lots of milkweed plants for them to visit. It's just hit or miss. So I really recommend, if you're into butterflies and you're really trying to draw them and you want to have monarchs as a possibility, sure, plant some milkweed. Be aware that it's a poisonous plant and the sap can be very irritating to the skin and eyes. So this, should be an adult supervised project. But plant lots of other things that bloom as well. Draw all kinds of butterflies. And when milkweed is blooming, by the way, you may not get monarchs visiting the flowers, but you'll get other things visiting, other butterflies visiting the flowers. They're not the only ones that go to them. It's just a caterpillar food source for monarchs. The adults of many types of butterflies like to visit the flowers, and they make a great addition to a border of other perennial flowers. And this is important to note, the ones that are native here, well, the one that's native here, the narrow leaf milkweed, usually doesn't bloom until its second or third year anyway. The showy milkweed, mine took 3 years to finally bloom. Now it's a very showy plant and it needs 5 feet of space. It's a big plant. Also quite pretty with this kind of dusky pink flowers when it's in bloom. But it didn't bloom the first 2 years at all and finally bloomed in its third year. That's why the tropical milkweed became so popular. It would bloom the first year. So milkweed is something you can add to a perennial border. It functions here as an herbaceous, deciduous perennial. You cut it back in the winter just because that stuff is all dead. It goes great with penstemon and salvia and native plants and like zauschneria and lots of other things that would give a longer season of bloom and complement it. And that way you won't be sitting there waiting for monarchs. Because I've never had monarchs on the ones on my property in all the years I've been here.
That you know of.
I would know because they'd be eating the foliage. So I would be seeing the larva. That's not happened. Someday it will, I'm sure, probably, but it's pretty hit or miss here in the valley.
If you want to attract butterflies, it's they really like having a place to land and then having flowers that they can suck the nectar out of easily. And so I would say yarrow, anything in the daisy family,
Definitely.
lots of flowers that are kind of flat, kind of have a pedestal where the butterfly can land.
The generalization I would make, though, is that focusing on a particular plant to attract a particular organism can be a little bit challenging. Yes, milkweed does attract. It's a larval food source. That's why we're growing it. We're growing it because the larva will feed on the plant. So every so often, someone will call me mid to late summer. I planted these milkweed. Now I do have caterpillars. They've destroyed the plant. Now what? Do you have any milkweed? And I thought, well, yeah, but they're just going to eat it completely to the ground when you plant it. Planting a whole bunch of flowers to have things blooming in your garden, native, non-native, it doesn't make that much difference as long as you've got something blooming all the time. So your garden becomes one of the stops on the visit sites that they go to, particularly hummingbirds will come back to the same place year, week after week, if not year after year. Hummingbirds are not are much more directed and much brighter, I will say, than butterflies. Butterflies are just random. They're floating by and they see a blotch of color down there and they see them differently than we see them. So they go down there and they go on to the next blotch of color. Hummingbirds remember and they come back to the same place year after year, apparently, as far as we can tell. So it's just having more diversity. The more diversity of blooms you have, the more diversity of wildlife you'll attract. It's that simple. And diversity includes native and non-native species, both in the blooms and in the things that you're attracting. I don't know what hummingbirds were native here in the valley 200 years ago, but I believe there's two or three species that sometimes overwinter here. And I don't know how long ago that started or whether that's always been the case in Northern California.
I think Anna's hummingbirds have always, some at least some of them have not migrated. But when you're talking about something blooming all year long, well, that's good for hummingbirds. But remember, butterflies don't live in cold. The butterflies will be gone. In
They show
fact,
up in my yard in mid-March to late March. The lilacs are one of the first things that draws butterflies in a big way, particularly swallowtails on my farm. And my first lilacs bloom mid to late March. That's when I really start seeing them. Hummingbirds, yeah, they're out there in January trying to find something blooming because there's not that
and in
much out there for them.
January, some of them have laid their eggs and they're looking for insects to eat too.
And they're out there.
So when do the butterflies die off, Don?
No, they. That's a very broad question. I would need to ask a butterfly expert how they vary by species with respect to their
Hey,
behavior
we
patterns.
have a butterfly expert in
We
Davis.
do, and monarchs are migratory. So, there are seasons that they come and seasons that they go. Planting things for larval food sources is also a little disconcerting to people who weren't thinking this through all the way. So, planting, for example, a Passiflora species because it's the food source of the Gulf fritillary butterfly. Neither the plant nor the Gulf fritillary butterfly are native here, but they're both well established in the Davis area. We now have a full resident population of Gulf fritillary butterflies. Your Passiflora is going to look really rough if they really find it and start ovipositing on it. You'll have essentially a defoliated vine with lots of cool butterflies hanging out on it. So be aware that
But
larval food sources are a different category of gardening than flowers that attract butterflies.
those vines, those Passiflora, they run up things and then the flowers show. And so if you've got a bush with the Passiflora vine in it, you won't see the eaten
Won't
vegetation.
be as visible, yeah.
But you'll also have those things all over. Well, that's not all of them. But the one I got,
We have talked about vigorous vines before on the program. Passiflora is a genus that has, if I recall, 4,000 species and cultivars that are out there. The Passiflora Society has a phenomenal resource. Most of them are too cold sensitive to grow here in Northern California. The majority of them are subtropical to tropical species, including the fruiting types that we sell, but we want people to know they need a little protection in the wintertime. Some species are very cold hardy, the Maypop, which is a Passiflora incarnata, if I recall. It's used for medicinal purposes as well as the flowers. It suckers profusely. I would never recommend it or plant it to anybody unless you have a yard where you just don't care about it doing basically what trumpet vines would like to do. But a lot of the Passifloras are vigorous but well-mannered in the sense that they freeze back enough to keep them more or less under control, but they will cover two to three sections of fence in a single summer, and they give lots and lots of bloom. The Xylocopa carpenter bees are very attracted to them. Many of our native smaller bees are attracted to them, and you'll see a lot of butterflies visiting them as well. It's interesting, though, that the Gulf fritillary butterfly likes certain species of Passiflora and not others, and will oviposit only on certain ones. So some of them, people plant them, they grow like crazy. They never see caterpillars. They, even though the butterflies may come to the flowers, they don't see the caterpillars on them. Others, they clearly like, and they will virtually defoliate the vine. It's a very vigorous plant. Don't worry about it. It will be back. But every couple of years, someone comes in with a picture of caterpillars eating the leaves on their Passiflora, wanting to know what to do about them. And I said, well, that's kind of why you planted it. What to do about it is get rid of the plant if you don't want the caterpillars eating the foliage. But it turns into a lovely monarch-like, same color, monarch-like butterfly, a little bit smaller, the Gulf fritillary butterfly. Not native here, but well-established in the Davis area.
Don sent me some photos. Indeed. And the first one that he sent me is I thought it was a bush. He says it's a tree. Yep. And it's big, but the photo is so fuzzy that I couldn't tell what it was. So he said, right, I'll send you another one. And this time, the picture that he sent me was, it had those yellow flowers at the edges, but then right inside that are the, what I would call, rosy red Japanese lanterns. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that and I went, that looks like a Colduteria, except ours doesn't make lanterns. And so what kind of Colduteria is this, and what kind is the one that we have?
Well, there's also a third picture that I sent.
Well, yeah, but that's a different plant.
That's right. So in the same week, two people came in asking, what's that yellow flowered tree? They both used the phrase tree in this case. And it seems to be really attractive to bees. And indeed, there are two yellow flowered plants blooming right now. Let's dispense with the shrub first. It is grown as a tree sometimes, but it's more commonly grown as a shrub. And it's the regular common Xylosma congestum.
And
someone had apparently cut a branch of this with a flower, taking it to, I think, the master gardener's table. And they were puzzling over it, because they were just looking at the flowers. Most people don't ever notice the flowers of Xylosma congestum. It's blooming right now. The flower is the exact same color as the leaves, which is why most people don't notice them when you're just going by one of the most common hedge shrubs in our area. Yes, it can be trained as a tree. So if you're at my nursery, for example, the building next door to us, the parking lot behind, there are Xylosma in little triangular planters in the parking lot, which have been trained up as trees because otherwise they'd be in the way of the cars that park there. So they look like trees. And it is it's a spectrum from shrubs to trees. It's not like this is a shrub and that's a tree. So Xylosma is usually grown as a shrub, but can be trained as a tree. In bloom right now, yellow flowers that look just like the foliage in terms of their color, and alive with honeybees. I mean, if you go up to a Xylosma shrub right now, the buzz from the bees will be audible from a few feet away. They're very happy when they're on the tree. They're not aggressive. They're not going to attack you. And so far, I've only observed European honeybees. It wouldn't surprise me if some of our native bees also go to these flowers. But this is a shrub from Asia that does extremely well in California. These plants that I'm referring to don't even get irrigated. They go all summer long without any direct irrigation, although I do believe they glean some from a nearby bed. They are not directly irrigated, and they've been there for more than 45 years. A very, very tough plant, yellow flowers, very attractive to bees. That was what one person was asking for, because it completely stumped some of these folks that were volunteering. The other one is very visible. You can't miss them. They're in full bloom right now in various parts of town. That was the one that you were referring to as the Japanese lantern look on the pods, which are following along behind the trees. Colruteria elegans, common name Formosan flame tree. And there are some in Davis. There's one very conspicuous one at the corner of F and L's. And that there can't be a corner of F and L, 8th and L streets. And that one I get questions about every year. The guy who lived in that house at least a couple of decades ago used to just keep a Xeroxed sheet at his front door, because people would come up starting about now through December asking, what is your tree out front? Because of the beautiful flowers, followed by the very showy bright red seed pods in November and into December. And so he just had a handout on the subject, Colruteria elegans,
followed by all those little pods dropping their seeds and sprouting up all over the yard.
No, But yes, here's the thing about this tree. Colorteria elegans is frost tender. And so we're just at the northern range of where it can grow. Seedlings do not come up underneath my tree at all, even though hundreds of pods go on the ground. I actually had to plant four in a row before one of them finally got through the winter and survived. Now, we had a long conversation about this on this committee that I was on that was reviewing trees for a recommendation to the public. And one of the things we look at is, does this tree have a propensity to reseed? Is this likely to become an invasive plant in our area? Is it invasive in other places? So now, right now, we're just talking about Colorteria elegans, a Formosan flame tree. I've never seen a seedling under mine, but seedlings do come up under the trees in the arboretum. And one of the arboretum folks was on this committee, and he said, "Don, there are seedlings under these trees, but only seemingly under those trees." One of the people who was a longtime staff person at the arboretum dug one of them up, took it home, planted it, and was very disappointed to find that what he had was clearly a cross between Colorteria elegans and Colorteria bipinnata. It's getting complicated here. There are
so the bipinnata is the one that reseeds all over. Place,
that one
right?
will recede somewhat and can be pretty, yes, pretty aggressive about it. But the really bad one is Colorteria paniculata. And those of you listening, even in much colder climates, will be familiar with the golden rain tree, Colorteria paniculata. It bloomed in July, same yellow flowers, followed by pods, which are not as showy, but you know, the tree's pretty when it's got a lot of these sort of pale pink pods on it. It's kind of salmony pink. They recede prolifically. I would not sell Colorteria paniculata. When I see it on a design plan, I strongly recommend it be removed. It's basically right up there with Albizia, the silk tree, in terms of how much of a nuisance it can become locally. And we definitely don't want to be planting Colorteria paniculata as a street tree because we would be, because of its invasive potential. Colorteria bipinnata, and the name tells you something. It's very easy to tell from the others. It's bipinnate leaves. They're twice divided. It's compound leaf that's compound again. Very easy to recognize. Very pretty. Its pods are sort of pink. Same yellow flowers. They were back in August, September. That one reseeds somewhat. It also can hybridize, since the blooms do overlap, with the Colorteria elegans, which does not generally itself reseed in this area. This is getting pretty complicated, but people ask about this tree because the pods on the elegans are quite showy. Tree Davis, over the last few years, planted some of them here and there around town. There are some in the arboretum, particularly as you walk in towards the Carolee Shields White Garden. I'm pretty sure those are Colorteria elegans. Be aware that if there's a bipinnata anywhere nearby, probably cross with your elegans and you'll have seedlings coming up. If you just have elegans, I can tell you something. We've tried to propagate this tree because people want it. I've gathered seed from first the one there at the corner of 8th and Elm, and then my own tree, and we get about a 3% germination rate. I'll plant hundreds and hundreds of seeds and we'll get 2 to 3%. They take a long time to grow. They're very gawky. We did it a couple times for people who really wanted them, and we've just decided it's really not worth the effort because of the amount of space you're putting into something that gives you like a 3% germination rate. If you really want one, send me a private message. We'll start the seed for you. But other than that, just enjoy them around town. But that's the yellow-flowered tree blooming now. All the other two species are done blooming as of a couple weeks ago. Colorteria elegans blooming now, already beginning to form the very showy pods on the tree that really make it stand out as we get into November and into December.
Is this for time for bulbs or not?
Most flower bulbs that we get, you can plant now. If you can find them, your hardware stores, even places like Costco sell bulbs. You can go ahead and buy daffodils, freesias, things like that, and plant them now. The only exceptions, and we try to mention this each week until it is time, tulips of the regular big flowered old-fashioned type, hyacinths of the classic fragrant ones, and giant crocus. Those are three that really need to go into cold soil, not warm soil. Their performance will be adversely affected by going into soil that is too warm. So those, tulips, regular true hyacinths, and giant crocus go in November, December, January. Everything else you can go ahead and plant if you're buying them now, or you can wait. They can go in later. We actually plant bulbs out in January. We pot up a lot of bulbs for sale in the spring. We do that anytime November, December, January, depending on what they are. So yes, it is a good time to plant them. It's just a little early for the tulips in particular. What happens if you put them into warm soil is they start to come up and then they stop and then they start to come up again and they do grow and they do bloom, but they don't bloom as well. So if you really want good performance from tulips, hybrid tulips, big flowered tulips, you wait until the soil is cooler for those. Good place to put them is in your refrigerator. Botanical tulips, which is my favorite term for species tulips. These are not your giant flowered Darwin hybrids, but the botanical tulips are usually varieties of different species with smaller flowers that are generally from Mediterranean regions, as most tulips were, or from Asia Minor, which is Turkey, basically. Most of those can go in any time, and most of those will multiply quite freely here, but they're not what you're thinking of when I say tulip. You're probably thinking of the nice, straight, orderly rows that they have in the Netherlands of big, giant Darwin tulip. Yeah, the flowers are 4 inches and spectacular colors. The botanical tulips are the ones I really prefer to sell in our area because they multiply very freely here. I'll have probably 10 different kinds of species or botanical tulips when my bulb supplier finally sends them in November. Those are great for this area. They multiply. They naturalize. They increase and sometimes become mildly annoying how much they multiply. Regular old tulips, no, they're typically a one and done or maybe a 2 year thing.
Okay, so if you plant them and they grow, and then next year, do you have to dig them up and then replant them in cold soil, or do they make it through even if the soil gets warm?
Generally, those are the ones that don't come back real well, but also digging them up doesn't work real well. So your best bet is to buy new ones each year. One of my employees left my business and then went to work at Tulip Mania in the Bay Area. Giant tulip festival. I think she told me they planted 34,000 tulip bulbs. They put them in cold storage when they arrive. They chill them for 4 to 6 weeks, which is what you'll read you need to do. You don't need to do that, but they did that for this reason. When you do that and you plant those bulbs at the same depth in the same kind of soil, those bulbs will all come up and bloom together. It'll give you that little Dutch soldiers look that we're all looking for. Apparently, we want all of our bulbs to bloom at the same time. You're doing this for the public. You're doing this for a public demonstration garden. Many years ago, Sunset Magazine, back when they were in Menlo Park, tested this as to whether you really needed to chill the bulbs or what would happen if you didn't. And the answer was, if you waited and planted them later, they wouldn't all bloom exactly together. You plant 12 tulips, they would bloom in groups of 2 to 3 over a period of a couple of weeks instead of all coming up and looking perfectly uniform. So if you are planning a public garden display or you have some event or something like that, you'll take your regular giant Darwin tulips and put them in the refrigerator 4 to 6 weeks, plant them at the same depth in the same kind of soil, usually in containers, but in beds that have been specially prepared for this. Especially prepared with gopher wire underneath them and squirrel cages over the top, because both of those animals love to eat tulip bulbs. So you do all this stuff and then they come up and they bloom together. But you don't need to do that. The bottom line, though, with most of those tulips is most of them don't come back. They might come back a second year, usually a little smaller, then they kind of fizzle out after that. In our climate, typically summer watering will cause the bulbs to rot. Some varieties will pop back up. I've had that experience. The Darwin hybrids, which is a long-standing category of large flowered tulips, typically will last 2 to 3 years, sometimes longer. You'll get a second year, although they'll tend to be smaller. I had one little group of those bloom for 10 years, 6 bulbs, 6 flowers, year after year after year, slowly getting smaller as the years went by, and then they just disappeared 1 year. I have no doubt the bulb is probably still down there waiting for the right conditions to sprout up and bloom again. Typically, you would dig them up and store them, but my experience with doing that is you injure the bulb, they rot. It just doesn't work that well. Just spend the money on some new bulbs, you'll get better results. Many other bulbs, all the others that we sell, daffodils, grape hyacinths, Dutch iris, narcissus, all those tend to multiply freely. I tend to focus on varieties as I do my selection for my own nursery of ones that I know will multiply here and increase quite well. But I do have regular old tulips for people who want that display. No, you do not need to put them in the refrigerator before planting. Just wait until the soil is cooler and plant them then.
I want to ask you about a particular iris. Now, I've heard it called a Pacific Coast iris.
Yep.
And I'm not sure if it's native in California or Oregon or what, but it's a beautiful little thing. Tell me about that. Does that overwinter?
Yeah, that's a native. It is it's a series of hybrids, actually. Usually sold as Iris Douglasiana, the Douglas iris, but there's 4 species, is my recollection, involved in the hybridization of these California native iris species from the oak woodland plant community, is my recollection. They typically grow on the edges of oak trees where it's sunny, but maybe shaded at certain times of day. in the Sacramento Valley, my experience is they definitely look better if they're shaded lightly, at least in the afternoon. But they're, other than that, they're pretty tolerant. It's not, it's a rhizome like most irises. Irises are rhizomes or bulbs. Both forms exist. The common bearded iris that you buy is a rhizome. These are also rhizomes, but they're very tight. So they look like a agapanthus or a grass. I mean, they're that kind of tight growth habit. And they spread outward slowly as a rhizome to get 2-3 feet across over a couple of years. And they have a lovely bloom in the spring. The original forms were mostly purple to light purple or blue. And there's a whole lot of hybrids. There were hybridization going on with the Pacific irises, as I usually see them described, or the Douglas irises for 40 years now. And all kinds of amazing hybrids have been developed with the same color range that you get in bearded irises. Fairly narrow bloom season, late spring to early summer. In our climate, extremely hot climate, dense soils that stay wet, they tend to rot. So they need to be carefully planted in a place that's lightly shaded in the afternoon, has good drainage, and will be irrigated carefully in the summertime. And if they're in too much shade, they won't bloom. So you need to find that right spot. And people who have found that right spot find them very, very easy to grow. But full sun, dense soil, irrigated in the summer, they tend to rot out after the second or third year. They're easy to grow otherwise. And here and there, there's been a variety that's come along that is just proven to be more adaptable. This is true with a lot of California natives in groups of ceanothus and manzanitas, for example. People who run nurseries specializing in native plants will do, boy, that one really looks good all the time. Looks good in containers, grows everywhere. You know, Yankee Point ceanothus, Howard McMinn manzanita. Well, in the Douglas iris or Pacific iris category, Canyon Snow is a white flowered version that is remarkably adaptable. It produces well in regular nursery conditions. So that right there is a big issue for a lot of native plants. Commercial nursery growers just have a lot of trouble with a lot of the natives rotting out in their usual production system. Well, this one seems to be very resistant to the usual nursery problems. Blooms in quart pots, which is great. So you can sell them in bloom in the spring. And very popular, and it holds its flowers up higher than a lot of the others. And it's a larger flower and it's white. So it really stands out. So Canyon Snow is a particularly adaptable Pacific or Douglas hybrid iris that has caught on with a lot of the regular nursery growers. You'll see that in nurseries that don't stock a lot of native plants because it just happens to be one that a lot of these other growers will do. Just very well adapted. If you happen to be on the other side of the Coast Range, a great plant for you. One of the best plantings I ever saw was probably 15 years ago at the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens in Fort Bragg. No idea if it's still going, but they had planted out a whole enormous bed of the Pacific Coast iris hybrids. And of course, you know, Fort Bragg, pretty much 62 degrees year round, very nice climate for a lot of things. They were doing very, very well over there, but they do grow in the valley. Just be aware that they can rot out pretty easily and maybe look for this one, the Canyon Snow. And there's some others in that strain that are on the market now. There's a purple one as well. So there are some cultivars that appear to be better adapted to interior gardens.
Yeah, the Pacific iris that I have happened to be put into the ground on the north side of a tree trunk. And so it's, you know, where the roots of the tree trunk go out, and there's a little bit of dirt in the old V-shaped area of dirt kind of higher up, and they're in there, and they're a little bit higher than everything else, and they're on the north side of the tree, so they don't
makes
get
a difference. Yeah, elevated a little
and
bit.
They do. They've been there for years.
Yeah, they don't mind the leaf litter, that kind of thing, as long as excess water percolates away from the crown. Well, I mean, that's true of most California natives. We want them in a slight mound. We want excess water to drain away. I keep having this conversation with folks looking. This is the time of year when people go around looking for native plants, and that's great. Most of us will bring in as many different things in the California native plant category as we can get a hold of. And they'll come in and they'll see they don't have that many ceanothus. And we'll have these long conversations about what they need. If you give them what they need, slight mound, for example, and irrigation till established, continue to irrigate them somewhat during the summer here. They're not something that wants to go all summer long without irrigation, but they don't need it more than about once a month. Avoid drip. Drip is a nightmare with ceanothus and manzanitas and Pacific irises. Use a spray system, but very, very, very intermittently and for a very long duration if you possibly can. You can do well with these things, but the key really is what Lois just alluded to. Elevate them. Elevate them so the water, excess water, always drains away from the crown. Just curious about the cold hardiness of the Pacific irises. So I got out my Sunset Western Garden book, this edition from 25 years ago. And the Pacific Coast irises are labeled for zones 4 through 24. right?
Wow,
sunset
that's
zone.
a huge range.
Yes, it is. 24 is what I grew up in, frost-free coastal Southern California. 4 gets you quite cold. And their comment is 11 species, okay, more than 4, 11 species native to the Pacific Coast states constitute a homogeneous group within the genus Iris. From several species, breeders have developed hybrids in a broad range of colors and patterns, white, blue shades, pink, copper, brown, maroon, violet, many with elaborate veining or patterning. Foliage is narrow. Clumps are like a coarse grass. Best conditions, sun to light shade, well-drained soil, moderate to scant water in summer. Scant. That's a term you don't hear very often.
Oh, sure, I do. I hear it all. I say it all the time.
Intense heat coupled with water and poor drainage can be fatal. Thank you, Sunset, for summarizing what we just said in a paragraph.
Did a good job, too.
In clay soil, grow in raised beds in organically amended soil. Interesting. Plant from containers anytime through spring, though spring and fall are best. Timing is critical in digging and replanting. Best moment is when new roots are starting to form. Scrape away soil at plant base to check. This ranges from early fall in colder regions to midwinter in mild winter areas. And by sunset, Western Garden Book definition, we're a mild winter area.
Yeah.
So try and find that information on the internet. I got to say, I'm using my Western Garden Book more than I did. In the last few months, I have the newest edition is sitting at my desk. And I used to just, you know, go on Google, see this, how big it gets. It's hopeless. Now, the Western Garden Book is right there, right at hand. Great resource, just 15 years out of date. Okay.
Okay, Don, here's a question. What happens when you buy a bush and then you plant it in an area where it doesn't get the light that it would prefer? Mm-hmm. What I mean is a sun-loving plant that is put into an area that has light but no direct sunshine. Does it stretch? Does it die? Does it not flower? Do the leaves change color? What happens to this shrub?
That was a pretty good list right there. You want to run through those again?
Yeah. Does it stretch?
Yes.
Does it mean that the lower buds don't grow?
Typically, yes, that's the case. Yeah.
Okay.
The internode distances will be wider as well, so it'll have a more open appearance than it would otherwise.
And does it die?
Usually not.
Does it just not flower?
In most cases, plants that prefer sun will not flower real well in the shade. Of course, there are plants that flower in the shade, but in general, if it's a sun-preferring plant and you put it in the shade, it won't bloom as well. Example would be someone came in and asked me about lantana recently, whether lantana would grow and bloom in partial shade. And,
that was, you know, me.
Yes, that's correct. It will grow. I can guarantee it will grow. It won't hurt the plant. It'll stretch. The internode distances will be wider, so it'll have a different appearance than it would in full sun. And then whether it will bloom really depends on what we mean by shade. Shade is not just one thing. Shade is a spectrum. My first landscape was under the shade of two fruitless mulberry trees. That's very deep shade. More common on the farm I'm on, you know, where I am now, the shade, my front yard is under the shade of a very high London plane tree. The first branch is about 20 feet up. So light gets in, even direct sunlight pokes through here and there, but it's shade for the most part. It's high light shade. Great gardening conditions, by the way. That's one of the easiest places to plant because you get some sun some of the day, but mostly light shade. That's not so difficult. Planting under the fruitless mulberry tree is the short list of plants that did well for me there. Aside from the root competition, the water demand, the mountains of leaves that come down in the fall, it was a very challenging environment. But the most challenging part of it was the growth habit of mulberries. They go out and then arch down somewhat. And so sun didn't even really come in under them at the end of the day or the beginning of the day. Very thick, large leaves, very densely foliated. Very few plants would grow there, and even fewer plants would bloom there. Whereas in the shade of a high sycamore or birch trees or that kind of thing, maples, you know, the higher, lighter shade, there are many, many plants that we can grow that will bloom there.
And do the leaves change color? What I mean is are they darker green or lighter green,
Yes.
more chlorophyll,
Yeah, and
less?
most important is plants that have a burgundy or red color in the leaf that tends to fade when you put them in the shade. So an example would be Japanese maples. If you have blood good or emperor and it was real intense color in the nursery, that was probably grown under 35 or to 50% shade cloth. You take it home and put it into shade that's more akin to 70 to 80% shade, the red color will fade to greenish. And so people are often disappointed that the Japanese maple doesn't have the intensity of color going into the summer as the shade from whatever it is, the trees increases, but they do need to be in at least partial shade here in the Sacramento Valley. So in particular, colors other than green will tend to fade if they're in more shade. And variegation, this is an interesting fact. Variegated leaf patterns tend to diminish as you put them in more shade. Abutilon savitzii, Abutilon thompsoni, you'll get less variegation if they're in more shade. They'll still be attractive, but they won't be as attractive. On the other hand, many of those plants also don't like full hot sun. So you have to find that sweet spot, like the shade of the high London plane tree, as opposed to the shade of the frilla mulberries.
Oh, I love this question. So, what winter vegetables can I plant that won't attract a ton of sow bugs? I think we have to have a talk about sow bugs
Yeah,
now.
they don't really hurt plants in general. They do a little damage to seedlings. They like decaying organic material, and they get blamed for the damage that earwigs do. I don't know of a plant that won't attract a ton of sow bugs. They do nibble on seedlings a little bit, but they are rarely the big problem. And so sow bugs are just part of the decomposition of organic stuff that's going on in your garden all the time. The presence of a large number of them doesn't indicate any problem necessarily. But I do suggest if you're having holes in the leaves and but going out with a flashlight and checking on your garden at night, it's a cool thing to do. Interesting things going on out there that you're not aware of. And you'll often find the culprit and catch them right in the act, whether it's a snail, slug, and by the way, they will come out when it rains. So we'll start seeing some damage from those snails and slugs, which here in the valley are rather seasonal. They like it when there's moisture on the soil. They like a light rainfall like we just got. I wouldn't be surprised if you're seeing damage from them that you're blaming on sow bugs. Sow bugs are like the good kid that got caught up with the wrong crowd. They're not directly responsible, but they're the ones that stayed behind and answered the officer's questions. So sow bugs are generally nothing to be concerned about. Earwig snails and slugs will do damage. We're also seeing damage from caterpillars on a lot of the brassicas, but I can tell you with the colder nights, they're slowing way down. The damage is diminishing. You can still hand pick them. Yes, you could spray with BT, which is an organic spray for caterpillars. But just be aware that as we get below 50 at night, that damage will practically cease. Yes, we're going to warm up for a few days, but they're easier to find. They're getting bigger. Hand picking them, killing them, and just being aware that's going to run its course. The caterpillars that you get on your brassicas are mostly an October problem, and colder nights will usually put an end to that.
Are sow bugs insects?
They're crustaceans. And they're delicious.
The mockingbirds and jays agree with you.
Yes,
Yeah.
crunchy.
Mockingbirds like to eat sow bugs. So our quote for the day is, successful gardeners in the Western states are those who learn how to water.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.